About them in the published biographical notes, but briefly, there's Professor Tony Smith from Victoria University at Wellington, New Zealand, but he also has some strong Cambridge connections still. Professor A.J. Brown from Griffith University and Professor Anne Toomey from Sydney University. I've been given some insights into the papers or the talks they're going to give this afternoon, and I think we're all going to find them very interesting. Different, but with some common themes throughout. I'm going to ask the speakers to try to adhere to the 20-minute limits, which should then leave us 15 to 20 minutes at the end for questions. Hopefully there'll be more questions than there were this morning. Professor.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for those brief words, Justice Finn. If I could begin by thanking the organisers of this event for inviting me. I was here last year and learned a great deal. I'm very happy to be back. Thanks in particular to Thernice Rue. I might say, though, Thernice, that if I ever get the chance to put you on after lunch, first time up. Despite the fact that Julia Gillard in Wellington the other day assured us that we're all family, I have to confess that I didn't find it particularly easy to find a topic that will cross jurisdictions. Our constitutions are remarkably divergent, but I think that in the notion of governing without a majority, I've got something that might be, I hope, of more universal interest. I've got a pretty inchoate and multi-stranded tale to tell because I'm trying to range across three jurisdictions, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. But to oversimplify at the outset, and at the end of it you might think I'm still oversimplified, hopelessly, but what's happened, I think, in the UK and New Zealand is that every effort has been made to take out the role of the Governor-General, or the palace, if you like, from the practices of coalition government. And in the course of that process, there has emerged in both countries a document entitled the Cabinet Manual. Now, I don't think the existence of this document is extremely widely known, but its subtitle is the Cabinet Manual, a guide to the laws, conventions, and the rules on the operation of government. And it's devised by the Cabinet Secretariat in both countries. And I think what's happened is that the UK have used the opportunity of the possibility of a coalition emerging to produce a version of a cabinet manual that looks strikingly like the one that was devised in Wellington starting in the 1970s. So the title of the paper contains an elliptic reference to Professor David Butler's book, Governing Without a Majority, and that book was subtitled Dilemmas for Hung Parliaments in Britain. Well, you might think that he didn't have an awful lot to write about because there hadn't actually been a hung parliament in Britain since 1931, and the most recent coalition government had been formed there under Winston Churchill during World War II, terminating in 1945. But the possibility that there might be an electoral deadlock is one that fascinates political scientists and constitutional lawyers, and in that sense the phenomenon of hung parliaments, it's a horrible expression, I know, but I didn't coin it, that manifested itself in the elections of 2010 in Australia and the United Kingdom is not that new. But as we know, the elections in both of those countries resulted in hung parliaments for the first time in 70 and 80 years respectively, giving rise to coalition-type minority governments in both cases. Like buses everywhere, you wait for just one for ages and then suddenly two come at once. So far as Australia is concerned, the phenomenon is perhaps less of a constitutional novelty since, of course, coalition governments are common in state jurisdictions. And Anne Toomey, the third speaker this afternoon, has been writing about that relatively recently. Nevertheless, the length of time that, if you like, was required between the announcement of the results of the recent federal election and the formation of the subsequent government, a period of 3.5 weeks suggests that there was in Australia an element of uncertainty surrounding the process and a degree of unpreparedness for what was about to take place. In the United Kingdom, by contrast, the resolution of the apparent impasse delivered by the electorate was hammered out remarkably quickly, remarkably given that the two parties concerned, the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, seemed very unlikely bedfellows at the beginning of the election campaign. On closer examination, however, we can see that this outcome was in fact the result of extensive preparations for the possible eventualities, in the course of which some of the constitutional conventions that are central to the process were manipulated, possibly changed quite significantly, and by a constitutionally remarkable process that centred around the creation for the first time in the UK of a cabinet manual that gave guidance on the working of the relevant conventions. And I should say that there have been a number of books published about the discussion processes and the government formation, at least five. I've read three of them. I haven't read the whole lot about exactly what happened. One of them extremely well informed by David Laws MP, who was one of the persons who had been made responsible for the conduct of the negotiations on the part of the Lib Dems well before the elections were held. In New Zealand, the third country whose experience has some bearing on the issues that I wish to discuss, coalition government of one form or another has been the norm since 1996, when the general election was held under the multiple member proportional voting system for the first time. The outcome of the election on that occasion in 1996 was not dissimilar to what happened in Australia last year. The balance of power was held by one of the small minority parties, New Zealand First, the leader of which, Mr. Winston Peters, held the nation to ransom for a period of 6 weeks before deciding where and with whom he would cast his lot. At one stage, he apparently put up on his door a sign saying, "Gone fishing," and he was just not to be contacted for some time. I think that would be regarded certainly subsequently as an act of utter irresponsibility, and Mr. Key has actually recently announced that whatever the outcome of the election, the next election, he will not have anything to do with Mr. Winston Peters. Now, such an outcome in the United Kingdom in 2010 would have been absolutely unthinkable as a matter of practical politics. The nation was, as we know, in the throes of an economic crisis of unprecedented proportion in modern times, and there were fears that a double-dip recession was a real possibility. The markets hate political uncertainty, and there was a shared sense, I think, among the main players in the negotiations that followed the election, that should the parties fail to find a way forward, and very quickly, the public were likely to be very unforgiving. Now, it's at this point that Whitehall, or at any rate the Cabinet Office, comes into the picture. They had anticipated the election result at a very early stage in the process and had taken the initiative to set in place new arrangements, including, as I said, adjustments to some of the conventions that attend the transfer of power in the UK. The process was described by the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Gus O'Donnell, in a foreword to the Cabinet Manual, written, the one I'm quoting from is actually December 2010, although he was talking about an earlier draft, when he said this, and I think there's a certain amount of Sir Humphrey Mandarin speak at work here. He says, "Before the last election, the previous Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Gordon Brown MP, asked that I lead work to produce a Cabinet Manual." And you sort of think, yeah, right. I mean, the economy's tanking. We're going nowhere in the polls. We're in deep trouble. I know what we'll do. We'll have a Cabinet Manual. I rather think that Gus O'Donnell was behind this particular notion. But he then says, "I published a draft chapter on elections and government formation in February 2010, and that draft chapter helped as a guide through the process of supporting the formation of a new government after the general election." And what that guide did was talk about issues such as the operation of the caretaker convention, and I notice in this country that the caretaker convention, the one that was circulated in 2007, was also circulated in 2010. But it also put the Cabinet Secretariat at the centre of the process of government making. And again, I see echoes of that in the caretaker conventions that I was talking about a minute ago, whereas in this country, I think the use of the public service in any way around the elections is something that's restrained. Here was the Cabinet Secretary saying, we will help, we will do what's necessary to help the parties come to some sorts of agreements about what's to be done. And the conventions which were applicable are described in the Cabinet manual. And you can contrast that, I think, with the situation that prevailed before that. A previous Secretary to the Cabinet, Lord Wilson, writing in 2004, talks about the sources of conventions in the United Kingdom Constitution. And he talks about the various textbooks that are used and things of that sort. And then he says, my final source, kept in a drawer, was the precedent book. 7 loose-leaf folders covered in tatty red plastic, full of loose slips of paper which have to be kept carefully in place, which each Secretary of the Cabinet hands on to his successor. In other words, so far as the Secretary of the Cabinet was concerned, you might think the status of conventions and the way in which knowledge about them has passed from one hand to the other is a pretty unsatisfactory inheritance. And it's not altogether surprising that Gus O'Donnell sought to improve the situation. Now, there's quite a lot of evidence that what O'Donnell did was inspired by a paper prepared by Professor Robert Hazel from the Constitution Unit at University College London, which had promoted the idea that it was important that there should be planning for the possibility of a hung parliament, and this planning might be progressed through the medium of a cabinet manual, as was done in New Zealand. And he says in the foreword, other countries with a Westminster-style system, this is Sir Gus O'Donnell, to the UK, have faced the same issue and consolidated their guidance. In particular, over the past 20 years, New Zealand has developed its own cabinet manual. Now, classically, the Governor-General, the monarch in England, has considerable reserve powers that are supposed to come into play, or possibly will come into play, in the situation where there is a hung parliament. And just to remind, there are powers to appoint a prime minister, to dismiss a prime minister. I hardly need to remind this audience that this was exercised in very controversial circumstances, of course, in Australia when Gough Whitlam was ousted some years ago. To refuse to dissolve a parliament and to force a dissolution of a parliament. And what happened just before the election, and this is part of the process, was that it was made very plain indeed that the palace was not to be involved in any of the arrangements around the coalition forming. In other words, there was a very strong signal given that the palace was not in the slightest bit interested in having to exercise any of these so-called reserve powers. And you see this in the draft where it says, a range of different administrations could potentially be formed, discussions will take place between political parties on who should form the next government. The sovereign would not expect to become involved in such negotiations. Now, that's Whitehall speak for don't you dare. Leave the monarch out of it. And even more remarkably, I think, the manual reads, there is a duty on the Prime Minister to act in a way that prevents the sovereign being drawn into political controversy by having to exercise these reserve powers. Translate that into the practical politics that were going on behind the scenes. We know that Brown was extremely keen to try and form an agreement with Clegg, the leader of the Lib Dems. But Clegg didn't want to speak with Mr. Brown, or as he would put it, listen to Mr. Brown. There was one remarkable phone call lasting about the best part of an hour and a half, and apparently Clegg was sort of standing with the receiver held at some distance from his ear, getting an earful on just how much really Labour and the Lib Dems should be getting into bed together. But as it happens, Clegg had said well in advance of the election that he was going to speak to the leader of the party which got the greatest number of votes. That happened to be Cameron, so he was going to talk with Cameron and see what he could do about forming a government. And I think that's the point at which the amount of preparatory work that the Lib Dems in particular had done with a view to seeing what it was that they could extract from the other parties in the way of what they wanted in terms of electoral reform and things of that sort kicked into play. And so Mr. Brown, I think, partly recognising that the game was almost certainly up, was off to the palace quite quickly, as it happens, to offer his resignation. I wouldn't want to read too much into what I'm about to say so far as Australia is concerned, but there was in Australia, before the election or during the election, some question about the possible appearance of bias on the part of the Governor-General in, because of her relation with, I think she was the mother-in-law of one of the candidates. And there's a letter, an opinion rather, of the Solicitor-General dated the 26th of August, which was shortly after the election, which says, in extraordinary circumstances, the Governor-General may be impelled to assume the profound responsibility of considering the exercise of a function on the basis of her own deliberative judgment. The possibility of extraordinary circumstances of that nature arising in the current state of uncertainty cannot wholly be excluded. But if I can now shift the focus quite quickly to New Zealand. New Zealand has marginalised the palace in the process almost entirely, and this was done in advance of the 1996 election by the then Governor-General, Sir Michael Hardie-Boys, who, in the language of Professor Philip Joseph, the writer of the leading book on constitutional and administrative law in New Zealand, just before the election held what Professor Joseph calls a series of media interviews to explain what he expected of the politicians. The primary responsibility for upholding the continuity of government rests with the political actors, not the Governor-General. Following a general election, the political leaders must broker party alliances to determine where the confidence of the House lies. They must express the outcome of their brokering publicly, as a fait accompli for the Governor-General and the voting public. In other words, although there are these reserved powers, they're not going to be used. It's a matter for the politicians to work out where it is that the confidence of the House is likely to arise. The nature of the coalition agreements varies quite considerably. In the UK, they're quite extensive, unlike the ones that were prepared here. And their nature varies very much according to the circumstances, but I don't think that in this country you have what I would regard as a full coalition in the sense that there are no ministers from any of the minority parties actually in government, either, as happens in New Zealand, either ministers in cabinet, but sometimes ministers outside cabinet too. And that can have a considerable impact on the constitution, and in particular the conventions of ministerial surrounding ministerial responsibility. There is either the full coalition type agreement, which does involve people in government, or you can have, as seems to be the case here, confidence and supply agreements, where the parties promise to vote for the government on issues of confidence and issues of supply. And then you get other kinds of cooperation agreements and enhanced versions of both. There are a number of aspects of the what happens to conventions, in coalition type governments. As I said, I think probably the most difficult one has been collective responsibility. The issue that usually arises and causes trouble is in connection with the appearance of unanimity when you've got people in government but not of government. What tends to happen is that the minority parties tend to start bickering amongst themselves, tend to fall apart. It's happening in New Zealand at the moment with the Maori Party. It's almost classically what happens. Because they are a very small part of the government, they have to struggle to keep their own identity. And you do get people in the minority parties who want the leadership of those parties to take a different line from the one that they are taking. And that leads to the possibility of a breakdown. Now, where that happens, where a government looks as though it's about to come unstuck in the course of its tenure, again in New Zealand, according to Joseph, it's the political leaders who are responsible for sorting it out. Political leaders bear the same responsibility where a coalition government collapses mid-term. They must clarify publicly whether they will support a minority government in office or stitch together an alternative government from other political groupings. Sir Michael Hardy-Boys quietly insisted that a political crisis was not a constitutional crisis and that the politicians must, in the end, resolve the political stalemate. And that view was endorsed by a later Governor-General, Dame Sylvia Cartwright. It is well established that if the government loses the confidence of the House mid-term, the Prime Minister should state that the government will operate as a caretaker government until the position is resolved. The Governor-General's role in this kind of situation is to ensure that a government of ministers with a clear democratic mandate is established or re-established. And in doing so, the Governor-General depends on the political parties represented in the House to clarify, within a reasonably short time frame, whether the caretaker Prime Minister can re-establish his or her support or whether an alternative administration can be identified from the existing Parliament. During this period, the caretaker Prime Minister's power to advise the Governor-General to dissolve Parliament and call an early election is subject to the caretaker convention. She actually goes on to say that is, it requires a support of the majority of the House, although that is not actually reflected in the Cabinet manual. Now, I should suspect I've got 2 minutes to go, so I will finish just by saying what happened after the election in the UK is that Gus O'Donnell actually used the draft chapter as the basis on which to prepare a cabinet manual, which he circulated just before Christmas 2010. And it contains, it's 150 pages, and it's matters relating to ministers of the Crown appointment and their role, ministers in the state sector, cabinet decision-making, elections, transitions and government formation, executive, legislature and the House, and official information. And if you want to understand anything, I think, these days about, well, certainly New Zealand, constitutional arrangements, a look at that cabinet manual is an absolute must. I finish with a quote from Dame Sylvia Cartwright. Although the Governor-General retains the residual reserve power to dissolve Parliament and call an election, he or she would exercise that reserve power only if there were a complete impasse and no other way of restoring a democratically mandated government. That, of course, would be a very undesirable outcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tony, and thank you very much, Judge, for the introduction earlier. It's my great pleasure to have been invited to follow on from Tony to discuss what is, in some respects, not entirely, but in some respects, a product of our own agreements at a federal level that have led to the current power-sharing arrangements at a federal level, which include a range of things, including commitments to constitutional reform in the term of this Parliament. So one of the interesting products of the arrangements that Tony was talking about can be some very significant shifts in policy and governance, which we're all quite aware of, but also what we've been squarely confronted with. Not that these issues are actually new, but what we've been squarely confronted with is a time frame for dealing with some very hard and fast proposals for reform of the Commonwealth Constitution. That's actually the most logical segue into my paper. I had another shameless bit of promotion to inflict on you. Nothing to do with the subject of the book, the sudden flair for shameless promotion, but the a few people in this audience, there's many people in this audience who have been helping me along the way, cooperating with a particular project that's leading to my biography of Michael Kirby coming out very soon. But I thought this was a quick way of saying a very big thank you to those people, and also to let you know that it is coming out, because I've been told at least twice, Michael Pelly's written in The Australian that it was overdue, not even long awaited, for which I bear no grudge. And but I have been told by at least two people that I'd given up on this project along the course of the way. So I wanted to reassure people that I hadn't given up. But the only other reason why I can get away with it is because there is a segue to the topic that I'm addressing now, which is that some people may or may not have been aware that Michael Kirby was the solicitor who briefed the late Gordon Samuels and Malcolm Hardwick in 1965-1966 to travel to Walgett to defend both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal arrestees in the second major freedom ride that took place in the mid-1960s on the road to many changes in Australian culture and politics and law, including the road to the 1967 referendum, which produced the version of Section 5126 of the Constitution that we have today. And that photo at the top there on the top left-hand side is the Freedom Riders. Michael Kirby wasn't on the Freedom Ride, but others were. Chief Justice Jim Spiegelman is in that photo. And the other two photos are of a group of young people who this very week, if people weren't aware, conducting the Freedom Ride 2011. If you're bored by this lecture, then you can look at this website here and on your mobile device and follow the progress of the Freedom Ride right now. And it's actually a very, very significant step. This is just one of the activities which is the type of which we're going to have to see a lot more if we intend to have the type of public debate that is capable of leading to the type of constitutional change that many people, I think, hope for and expect. As far as I'm aware, there is no evidence that any of the Freedom Riders have been struck to the ground and spat on, as Jim Spiegelman was in 1965 in Walgett, or I think it was Moree. And so that in itself has got to be good news. But the comparison between the 1960s and now is obviously very apposite. It's very important for us to think about what does it take, what's it taken in the past for us to achieve constitutional reform, and what's it going to take now for us to achieve constitutional reform, if indeed you agree that any constitutional reform is necessary or desirable. There are three issues that are on the table. And as I said, two of these issues are issues that are specifically canvassed or specifically committed to by the government in its power-sharing agreements with the Independents and the Greens, by which the federal government exists today. One is some form of recognition of Indigenous people, Indigenous Australians in the Commonwealth Constitution, and a referendum to achieve that result within the life of this Parliament. The second is recognition of local government in the Commonwealth Constitution within the life of this Parliament, referendum to be held before or at the time of the next election in both cases. The third issue, which are somewhat dark, not intended to be dark and gloomy pictures on the left-hand side, are last weekend's health agreement and the health agreement before that from last year, the Prime Minister and Premiers getting together. And the reason why I've put it up there as a third issue is because although we have these two issues for which there have been specific commitments, many of us know that behind this discussion about these constitutional reforms are other issues, especially issues to do with the working of the federal system as a whole, with a large background of debate, analysis, discussion, concern, right across the entire community, not just amongst the constitutional scholarship community. or practitioner community about what can or should be done with the Constitution in the short, medium, long term to deal with what is the current state of our federal system. So in some ways, behind these two issues, there is another elephant in the room, which is very big. And the reason for highlighting that there are these three issues will become more and more apparent. In terms of types of recognition, this is now where we're at in terms of, as a nation and in terms of the stakeholder interests and the parliament, is figuring out, well, what exactly type of recognition in each of these two immediate cases are we talking about? And in both cases, there's been a lot of thought over the years and a lot of analysis. Most recently, Megan Davis and Dylan Lino from the Indigenous Law Centre at UNSW published an options paper on Indigenous recognition, which some of you will have seen referred to in the newspapers, which gives a sense of the spectrum of the major options. Last year, Nicola McGarrity and George Williams from UNSW published a very good article in the Public Law Review, again, canvassing the range of options for local government recognition, with others of us having also written things over the years. And there's history to both of these questions, previous attempts no less, in 1999 and in 1988 and in 1973. So there's a lot of history which I'm not planning to canvass, but it's all there. But what we know is that we've got some very serious decisions. Stakeholder groups have very serious decisions. Experts have very serious decisions. Governments, parliaments have very serious decisions, and so does the entire nation as to what type of recognition we're looking at. And that's just my sort of breakdown, putting the two together for the first time to sort of help try and navigate the landscape as to how serious we want to be, how much risk we want to take, what's compatible with our constitution, with our culture, with our political culture, what's politically feasible, what's meaningful, etc. We can, I'm sure if there's time, have plenty of questions and discussion about those things. I would just throw in here at this point that a gratuitous idea that if we're not having very serious major discussions about these different types of recognition, what they mean, how it will all work, if a community like ours isn't having that and having it very soon, then it's just one of the indicators that any kind of time frame for trying to get a result on these things within the term of this parliament has got to be confronted as being likely to be fairly unrealistic given what we all know about our track record and the complexity and the interesting challenges of constitutional change. Perhaps next year this conference could be held back-to-back or as part of a convention that is intended to help stimulate and progress that debate if that's not already happening or even if it is already happening. That's just sort of the first of my gratuitous ideas for today. But what I wanted to spend a few minutes running through just to help, I guess, give some impression that the remainder of my gratuitous opinions are based on some sort of research and evidence, is share with you a few highlights from the empirical research that a number of universities have been doing through the Australian Constitutional Values Survey, which we instituted for the first time 3 years ago now, which we've run twice and for which we'll be looking for funding to run again next year, to try and tap into or try and reach down further than has been attempted before a few different levels as to understanding our political culture and Australians' attitudes towards their institutions, particularly federal institutions, and their constitutional structures and practices more generally than we've had the benefit of previously as we've gone through these types of change debates. So the two surveys that I'll make passing reference to, and the surveys themselves and more of these results are available on our website, and this presentation will be available, so you have to excuse me if I skip across the top a little bit, but two surveys, one in May 2008 and one in March 2010, well before the last federal election. National surveys, telephone surveys conducted with News Poll, results weighted to give a representative picture of adult public opinion, unless indicated otherwise. And the Questions that I'll just focus on today, a much bigger survey, a lot more results, but the questions I'll focus on are the questions that we ask about whether Australians believe there should be recognition of local government in the Constitution or not, which we ask as part of a whole battery of questions. And then immediately after that, how important Australians think it is or was to hold a referendum to make particular other changes sometime in the next few years. And the questions that we put, the general issues that we put to people, and obviously these are just general statements without any specificity as to what type of recognition in the Constitution, are a referendum to decide if Australia should become a republic, a referendum to recognise the history and culture of Indigenous Australians in the Constitution. One might say a very sort of symbolic form of recognition, deliberately non-threatening in some respects, no mentions of rights or anything like that in that question. A referendum about what levels of government Australia should have, very general, the structure of the federal system, and a referendum to decide which level of government is responsible for doing what in Australia. And the some of the results are encouraging, some of the results are just very sobering in terms of reminding us of the reality of what we know we're dealing with. And this gives the national picture in terms of the green is those people who said it was very important to hold a referendum in the next few years on each of those four things. The yellow is those people who think it's somewhat important. So you've got important up to the top of the yellow, and then the red is the people who said it was not important to hold a referendum on any of these things in the next few years. So this is March 2010. And as you can see, and this was widely reported, in terms of overall importance, high levels of large proportion of the Australian population agreeing that it's potentially quite desirable, important to address these things potentially through constitutional change. 74.7% of Australian adults in relation to some form of Indigenous recognition, potentially. And that was widely reported as being pretty good for the cause, for those people who are supportive of that principle, as certainly I am. But there's also some other messages in there. The two right-hand columns really confirm, I guess, what a lot of us sort of know or suspect, which is that when it comes to their system of government, Australians are most interested in seeing the whole federal system sorted out, and that that's overall a higher priority, even though Indigenous recognition is a high priority. The poor republic languishes back in the somewhere back down the field, but I don't think that's a surprise to too many people at the moment. When you break it down by state, you get a very interesting picture. This is just the people who think that each of these four things is very important. And all the indicators are from the data that these are the people who are most likely to actually not just think it's important to have the referendum, but to actually potentially vote in favour of that actual reform. And you can see that it starts to dip quite substantially below the 50% mark that you would want, and you start to see some of the variations between states, which start to make it much more real, the sophisticated nature of the complex nature of the challenge and the sophisticated nature of the process that would be required to actually capture the potential for support, depending on what type of recognition we're talking about here. Could spend a lot of time talking about that. Some of the really sobering data comes with something like not so much about around Indigenous recognition, for which I think there is potentially very strong support, but support which could easily evaporate and evaporate quickly and terminally if there's conflict over what type of recognition and why and whether or not which Indigenous groups, and some of the Indigenous leaders have debated this in the media, which Indigenous figures and groups are supporting which option and other parallel debates to that that'll go on in the wider community. So, I mean, my overall assessment with my political science hat on is that there's potentially very strong support out there for Indigenous recognition, but that it could be support which evaporates extremely quickly depending on the nature of the process and the debate. With local government recognition, there is baseline borderline support when it comes down to it on the analysis using the questions that we use. And that hasn't shifted over the 2 years, for which we've got 2 years of data. These columns, each of them, the ones on the far, your far left with the green and the red, are the national picture in 2008 and then 2010. You can see no real difference between the yes recognise, which is the green, and the no don't recognise, which is the red. Interestingly, not a lot of variation in each of the states between the 2 years, and there's the six states. The biggest variation is in Queensland, where there was a huge local government amalgamation debate happening in 2008, which obviously lifted the profile of the issue. But in 2010, Queensland had dropped back to something more similar to other states. Very borderline. No referendum is going to get up if the state of public opinion remains like that. There's other data that we've got, some of which was published previously in the UNSW Law Journal, about the potential for shifting that picture, for actually changing how people think about a proposal like recognition of local government, inclusion of local government in the Commonwealth Constitution, if they come to understand that it is about certain things, that it's not just about a symbolic change, or it's not just about protecting local government or giving local government what it wants or giving it more money for no reason because it's asking for it or anything like that. But if there's a perception that we're doing this in order to fix problems in local government, and if we're doing it to fix problems in the federal system, and that we're doing this as part of a positive plan for actually taking the federal system forward in a whole range of ways, then support is out there waiting to be gathered on my analysis. If that isn't achieved, then it will be no surprise to anybody, putting even aside other issues, it'll be no surprise to anybody if most Australians don't quite simply say, as Greg Craven is already predicting, well, local government, it's corrupt, it's weak, it's hopeless, it's pathetic, it doesn't get its job done most of the time, why would we stick it in the Constitution? So we've got a really acid test here. And there are various reasons why we know we've got that acid test. We know that people are very questioning of the federal system overall. We know that a very large proportion of Australians actually don't think we should have a level of local government at all, or if they had their way, we wouldn't have a level of state government. Shouldn't we actually be dealing with the bigger, harder issues in our federal system? And if there's some evidence that we're doing that, and local government recognition fits into that, then maybe we'll do it. But otherwise, why would you? And all my research indicates to me that Australians are actually remarkably sensible and practical when it comes to working through those questions, as opposed to, I suppose, the convenient stereotype of saying that Australians just simply don't know enough and are too ignorant to come up with anything better than voting no. What's it going to take? Really, some of my gratuitous final take-home message here is I guess my own sort of repackaging, my own assessment and reinterpretation of what many other people have said. I don't just promote my own books. There's another fantastic book on sale outside the door by George Williams and David Hume called People Power, all about the history of referenda. If you haven't bought it or your library hasn't, you should go out and buy it. But there's many, many other people. I mean, really a high degree of consensus from all those people who look at referenda and constitutional change processes about our need to take a much more sophisticated approach and what it's going to take to actually do this properly. So some of those things are my listing there. Well, I mean, that's the way that I present it to my students and anyone else who's interested in terms of the relationships between the key things that need to inform a process. I'll skip over some of the other interesting data that I had. We can come back to it if we're absolutely dead for questions. But in terms of how to operationalise that triangle, I've also given a gratuitous list now, which in terms of where we stand now. At the moment, we have a panel which is excellent, of an expert panel, a referendum panel that is starting work on figuring out over 12 months, figuring out what type of Indigenous recognition we should be talking about and how it should be achieved. As yet, we've had a process underway through the Australian Local Government Association for local government to figure out what its position is in terms of what type of recognition it thinks it wants in the Constitution. But we've so far we've haven't even scratched the surface of any process or any well-resourced process for starting to figure out how to resolve those questions in a way which will engage the Australian community in that whole process. So there are many things, I think, that we can talk about as to what it's going to take. The important thing is that we actually start having the debate. It's a national debate. We're talking about the Constitution again here, folks. So it's a debate in which everybody is going to have to participate, and no people are going to be more important than the types of people who are in this room. But so far, we, for an almost impossible timetable, we basically haven't even taken, or we're only just starting to take some of the first steps in processes which we know need to be much more sophisticated and much more complex than any that we've seen any evidence of so far. So I think the main, you know, my main take-home message today is that we have to, I think, speak with one voice to governments and political interests about the, as people who know something about these things, not just me, but many other people in this room know a lot more than I, about the need for this to be taken seriously right now if we're going to actually have any hope of having any kind of constructive debate on these issues prosecuted to any kind of even interim conclusions within the lifespan of this term of Parliament. And that may sound like a sort of a warning and somewhat depressing. I'm actually very excited about both of these reforms as well as the potential for larger processes in this sort of area. But I think at this point we have to be very serious about this, and I look forward to further debate, further discussion, any questions about how we get serious or how we should get serious. Thank you very much.
On the 3rd of March this year, the Australia Acts will have been in operation for 25 years, so effectively the 25th birthday of what is arguably Australia's full independence. This year also marks the 80th anniversary of the Statute of Westminster, which was responsible for giving us partial independence at the Commonwealth level. So it's a good time to pause and reflect upon the significance of these statutes in achieving Australia's independence from the UK and their potential future use, and in particular in relation to a republic or indeed Indigenous recognition in the preamble of the Constitution, there being all sorts of fascinating constitutional issues about how you actually amend the existing preamble. But the question is, will anyone actually be celebrating on the 3rd of March this year? Apart from me, that is. And the answer is, well, probably not. For the most part, people don't know what the Australia Acts are, which is slightly problematic when you've written a book on it. And shamelessly, I'll tell you, they're selling it outside. Very good price. Also, even if people do know that the Australia Acts exist, everybody had the view that Australia was well and truly independent before 1986. And so, you know, why do we care about it? How significant is it? In fact, Gareth Evans tells this great story about when the Queen came to Australia to proclaim the commencement of the Australia Acts. He came face to face with Prince Philip, and stuck for anything to say, sort of told him a bit about the Australia Acts, how incredibly important they were, how constitutionally significant they were, and how chuffed he was to have been involved in a small way in their creation. And Prince Philip just stood there, sized him up, gave a long, narrow-eyed pause and said, "Big deal." Most people probably would regard it as perhaps not a big deal, accepting Prince Philip's analysis. But for constitutional lawyers, it actually was a very big deal. The Australia Acts are important for three reasons. First is that they finally established Australia's independence from the UK. They terminated Australia's constitutional ties and ended the status of the Australian states as colonial dependencies of the United Kingdom. Secondly, there is an enormously important federalism aspect to the Australia Act, which I don't think many people recognise. The Australia Act conferred full power on the Australian states and enhanced their status as partners with the Commonwealth in the sharing of Australian sovereignty. And the third point is about that sovereignty. The Australia Act effectively repatriated the Constitution by ensuring that all power over all Australia's fundamental constitutional documents is placed now in Australian hands. And that power is shared through Section 15 of the Acts, Australia Acts, between the Commonwealth and the states. So crucial to all three of those outcomes, independence, federalism and sovereignty, is Section 15 of the Australia Acts, which provides, first of all, for the entrenchment of the Australia Acts, their supremacy over other laws, state or Commonwealth, and for their future amendment, along with that of the Statute of Westminster and through the Statute of Westminster to the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act. Now, the negotiation of the Australia Acts was as much a struggle about federalism as it was about the termination of residual constitutional links with the United Kingdom. Once the United Kingdom vacated its constitutional role with respect to Australia, the vital question was who would fill the vacuum? Would the Commonwealth fill the role that the United Kingdom had played in relation to the Australian states? Or would the states themselves assume this position and therefore assume an unprecedented degree of self-government and internal sovereignty? Now, this issue is far from theoretical. If the Commonwealth took over the UK's powers and therefore had the power to advise the Queen in relation to the who gets to be appointed as governor, the removal of the governor, instructions to the governor, the grant of royal assent to reserve bills, and even critically, the power to disallow state laws, you can imagine the enormous powers that the Commonwealth would have over the states if they achieve that status. Now, needless to say, the states were never going to have a bar of the Commonwealth taking up that role, and indeed that's one of the significant factors as to why the states stayed outside the Statute of Westminster to begin with and were prepared to take the status of colonial dependencies of the British Crown rather than have the Commonwealth dominating them in this fashion. But when we got up to the point of the negotiation of the Australia Acts at the beginning, the Commonwealth was still pressing its view that once the UK departed from the constitutional scene, it was going to take over. So first of all, the Whitlam government took that view, and very strongly the Fraser government did as well. And this was the fundamental sticking point in the negotiation of the Australia Acts. The states, of course, said that they were only prepared to do this if they got to advise the Queen directly, but the other stumbling block was the Queen did not want to be advised directly by the states. She'd met Joe Bjelke-Petersen. She had various views about state premiers, and in particular, she was concerned that they might give her, quote, outlandish advice, unquote. Now, the story of most state-federal battles in Australia is one where the Commonwealth wins, usually due to its financial dominance. And this is one of the very rare cases where the states actually prevailed. The Fraser government initially insisted that the Commonwealth would advise the Queen about all state matters once the British bowed out. But interestingly, when the Hawke government was elected in 1983, they were prepared to take a much more flexible position on this. The first approach they proposed was known as the postbox solution. Under this, the Prime Minister still would have advised the Queen, taking into account the Queen's concerns, so it would have, the advice would come from the Prime Minister, but would do so as a postbox for the states. So the states are effectively channelling the advice through the Prime Minister without the Prime Minister having any say. Now, that last bit was a bit controversial because, again, Senator Evans had suggested to Buckingham Palace that actually the Prime Minister would shove his advice under the table to the Queen. Apparently, Her Majesty was not amused. But anyway, as fate would have it, this proposal was killed off not by the palace and not by the states, but actually by an internal dispute within the Commonwealth government itself. The Attorney General's department under Gareth Evans supported the postbox proposal, but the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet and Sir Geoffrey Yean, who was the head of it, was very much against it. Sir Geoffrey's killer argument to Bob Hawke was, well, what if Queensland decides that the next governor should be Sir John Kerr? You would have to advise the Queen to appoint Kerr as governor of Queensland. Could you swallow that? The answer was no, and that was the end of the postbox solution. The next proposal was that, well, maybe the Governor-General could do the job. So the Governor-General could either advise the Queen, taking on the recommendations from the various states, and then the Governor-General would do the advising, or all the Queen's responsibilities, powers and functions with respect to the states could be delegated under Section 2 of the Constitution to the Governor-General, and the Governor-General would do them on state advice. That one got killed off as well for a couple of reasons. The first one was that Buckingham Palace pointed out that the Governor-General can't advise the Queen. Only responsible ministers can advise the Queen, and the Governor-General's not one of them. So as far as they were concerned, it was a dud. But the second reason it got killed off was actually the Governor-General managed to put a stake into this one. The Governor-General, Sir Ninian Stephen, pointed out that it was the Queen of the United Kingdom who had responsibilities in relation to the Australian states, not the Queen of Australia. The Queen of Australia at this stage, pre-1986, only dealt with the Commonwealth level of government. So Sir Ninian said, if those powers were delegated to him, they would be delegated to him by the Queen of the United Kingdom, not the Queen of Australia. And the consequence of that would be, while he was acting as a delegate of the Queen of the United Kingdom, he could not take any advice, instruction or anything from the Commonwealth Prime Minister, because the Commonwealth Prime Minister would have no jurisdiction whatsoever in relation to the delegate of the Queen of the United Kingdom. Constitutionally, a completely separate thing from him and the Governor-General acting in relation to the Queen of Australia and the Prime Minister. And Sir Ninian was clearly making sure that he was never put in a position to have to deal with this, said, and my understanding is that you really do want to have a say in relation to these state matters, and you'll never get me to do this because I'm going to be the delegate of the Queen of the United Kingdom, and I don't think you really want this, do you? So a little letter note on the side of the letter, you know, given the Governor-General's views, you know, that's the end of this idea. So after various other ructions and the like, and an entertaining meeting between Mary Gaudron as Solicitor General of New South Wales and some British diplomats in London, where they all spoke at completely at cross purposes. Mary Gaudron, as you would know, speaking in a very blunt, direct Australian style. British diplomats speaking diplomat speak and being on completely different levels. Mary Gaudron came back to Australia and said it was her understanding that the British would accept direct advice from the states to the Queen. I might add, some months later, when the British found out that this was the view that was taken of the meeting, they were absolutely horrified that the issue had been completely misconstrued. They were just being polite. They weren't actually meaning that. But by this time, Justice Gaudron had come back, told all the other states, the state solicitors general had amended the Australia Acts, providing for direct advice from the states to the Queen. Sir Geoffrey Yean, who the British described as a spider in the web of constitutional reform in Australia, he accepted that this was the price to pay to get what the Commonwealth wanted, which was Privy Council appeals being terminated. So they were prepared to buy this, and by this stage you had six states in the Commonwealth, seven governments, all agreed that there should be direct advice to the Queen. This was when, of course, the Queen decided that this was not a very good thing, but in the end, after more years of ructions and kerfuffles and the like, Sir Geoffrey Yean went to London and said to Her Majesty, well, here's our informal advice, Your Majesty, that you accept the Australia Acts, and if you don't like it, it's still going to be our formal advice, which leaves it to you to reject the formal advice of seven governments and cause a republic if you really want to, ma'am. That's a bit of a paraphrase. I don't know that he exactly used those words, but that was the gist of what occurred. The consequence was that Her Majesty somewhat reluctantly agreed to accept state advice directly from state premiers. But critical to all of that background and that history of the states achieving the right to deal with the Queen directly and avoiding the Commonwealth dominance, critical to all of that was Section 15 of the Australia Acts. The states did not trust, surprisingly, the Commonwealth to actually maintain the agreement that had been reached. They had some experience with the Statute of Westminster when that had been negotiated. Various commitments had been made to the states about the Commonwealth wouldn't enter into it without future negotiations and changing the statute to meet the needs of the states, which sort of never happened. And, of course, there's the issue of the Statute of Westminster being intended to be entrenched and putting in protections to the states and the Commonwealth coming around later and saying, oh, by the way, we can amend it unilaterally ourselves. So the states are pretty concerned that the same thing might happen in relation to the Australia Acts. You negotiate these Australia Acts, it's an intergovernmental arrangement, but then later on the Commonwealth comes back and says, oh, and by the way, we can amend this unilaterally ourselves and change it however we like. So what was critical for the states and critical for the entire deal with the Australia Acts was to somehow entrench them in a way that the Commonwealth could not unilaterally amend, that there needed to be state involvement in the amendment of the Australia Acts. Now, how to achieve this? Negotiation of the Australia Acts show that sort of the first attempts are looking at a Section 128 referendum type of approach. But then people thought, not really such a good idea. We know it's actually really quite hard to achieve, as AJ has pointed out. And not to mention, if you're from a state point of view, it's the Commonwealth that gets to initiate referenda, never the state. So generally, not such a brilliant idea. Ditch that idea. Western Australia says, well, if we're going to have this parallel system of two Australia Acts to achieve this outcome, because there were doubts about whether 5138 was sufficient to support the Commonwealth version, and you're going to have a UK version as well, makes sense if we change the two in exactly the same way. So why don't we use Section 5138 mechanism of getting the parliaments of all the states directly concerned to request and consent legislation, and then the legislation is enacted by the Commonwealth. That makes sense because it involves the states, it involves the Commonwealth. It's a system that's already used in the Constitution, and that's sort of the way to go. There was a bit of a debate at the time as to whether you needed to entrench the UK version of the Australia Acts. Some people suggested maybe it's spent once it's enacted, and so you don't need to entrench it. It was actually John Finnis of Oxford who stressed to the states very strongly that, no, you do need to entrench the UK version of the Australia Acts, because if the Commonwealth version doesn't work and the Commonwealth entrenchment doesn't work, the UK version and its entrenched status is the only thing that's going to preserve and protect the Australia Acts from unilateral Commonwealth legislation. And so that's the approach that the states took. There were various arguments at the time, which I won't go through because I don't have time, but about 5138 and whether it would, whether it itself is a form of entrenchment, so that once you enact a law under 5138, you can only amend or repeal it in the future using 5138, or whether you can use another Commonwealth legislative power to do it and all the rest of it. All very complicated and difficult. But in the end, what the states bowled up to the Commonwealth was effectively Sections 15(1) and Section 15(2) of the Australia Acts, which said that the only way of amending the Australia Acts and the Statute of Westminster would be legislation enacted by all the states requesting legislation enacted at the Commonwealth level. Now, that was put to the Commonwealth in November 1982. The Commonwealth responded that, quote, the necessity for, let alone the desirability of, this clause is not apparent. States said it was essential. They stressed that all elements of the constitution of the states and the Commonwealth should be capable of repeal or amendment by future generations. As there was to be parallel legislation, Commonwealth legislation and UK legislation, with some states relying on the efficacy of the UK Act and some on the Commonwealth Act, both would need to be amended by the same mechanism simultaneously in the future. And thirdly, as the Australia Acts and the Statute of Westminster will remain fundamental parts of the state constitutions as well as the Commonwealth, it is appropriate to have an amendment mechanism that involves all the states as well as the Commonwealth. Now, the Commonwealth argued, hey, we already have power to amend the Statute of Westminster. And that the statute should therefore be excluded from the entrenchment clause. Now, this is sort of, you know, salt into the wounds of the states, who have always objected and argued that the Commonwealth did not have a unilateral power to amend the Statute of Westminster, but, you know, that's a fight I will bypass for the moment. But interestingly, the Commonwealth Solicitor General, Sir Maurice Byers, objected most strongly to the inclusion of entrenchment of the UK-Australia Act. This was because Section 2.2 of the Statute of Westminster gave the Commonwealth power to amend any future UK Act insofar as it became part of the law of the Commonwealth. So the UK-Australia Act would be a future act under the Statute of Westminster, and clearly it would then be within Commonwealth legislative power to alter the UK-Australia Act unless you put in some kind of specific entrenchment provision that actually amended impliedly or expressly Section 2.2 of the Statute of Westminster. Sir Maurice regarded it as unthinkable that the UK Act should be entrenched as it would hamper the legislative freedom and sovereignty of the Commonwealth Parliament in the future. Now, the State Solicitors General formed the suspicion that Sir Maurice was prepared to include Section 15 in the Commonwealth Australia Act on the basis that it would be invalid and be of no legal effect. It was in effect, Section 15 of the Commonwealth version of the Australia Act was in effect deliberately set up to fail so that the Commonwealth could achieve unilateral legislative power to amend the Commonwealth version of the Australia Act and then could amend the UK version because of Section 2.2 of the Statute of Westminster. However, all this would be undone if the UK version of the Australia Act were entrenched by the inclusion of Section 15, overriding Section 2.2 of the Statute of Westminster. And would also mean that any unilateral legislation to amend the Commonwealth version of the Australia Act would be repugnant to the UK version of the Australia Act and therefore would be ineffective. So this was the protection that the state sought. Long battle over this with the Commonwealth and within the Commonwealth. Dennis Rose ended up advising that the Commonwealth should accept this and that it was reasonable to do so. But Dennis added a qualification. He said that it should be subject to any existing Commonwealth legislative powers under the Constitution to amend the Commonwealth version of the Australia Acts. So Rose argued for the acceptance of Sections 15.1 and 15.2, and that was eventually accepted over the continuing objections of the Commonwealth Solicitor General. But what's interesting was that Rose's qualification that Section 15 not detract from any powers of the Commonwealth Parliament that already existed under the Constitution was not included. But instead we got the mysterious Section 15.3, which was added in. And it provided that nothing in Clause 15.1 limited or prevented the exercise... the exercise by the Commonwealth of any powers that might be conferred on it in the future by constitutional amendment. Okay, so it's only constitutional amendments that give you extra powers in the future, not a preservation of any existing Commonwealth legislative powers, which is quite critical. As many of you will know, there's been a long debate about Section 15.3 of the Commonwealth version of the Australia Act. Is it effective at all? Does it confer an extra power on the Commonwealth that it didn't already have? Is the Commonwealth version at all effective? Most people seem to think it doesn't work at all, but the Section 15.3 of the UK version might, although if it does, arguably, you know, does it actually have the effect then of amending the Commonwealth Constitution by conferring additional powers on the Commonwealth legislature? There's a long debate about that, and there's articles by Dennis Rose and Jeff Lindell and various others on the topic, which I, again, don't really have time to go into. The answer, though, in the end, is that the states prevailed. Section 15 is entrenched in both the UK version and the Australian version. The Commonwealth, not surprisingly, has attempted to convince the High Court that the UK version is no longer relevant because we're all nationalistic now and we have to trace everything to Australian sources, as the High Court said in Marquet. Ironically, they say, you know, to Australian sources, i.e. the Commonwealth Constitution, which, by the way, was enacted in a British Act of Parliament by some people in England, in the same way as the UK version of the Australia Act as well, which, by the way, was also written in Australia, negotiated in Australia, has Australian sources and can only be amended by Australians, and therefore one might think was just as Australian as the Commonwealth Constitution. Go figure. Not a really convincing argument. Anyway, so wind up. Section 15 of the Commonwealth Australia Act is flawed and ineffective. 5138, which supports it, would not appear to be capable of supporting a provision which A, limits the application of other heads of Commonwealth legislative power, B, limits the types of amendment that can be made to the Commonwealth Constitution, and C, amends the Statute of Westminster. But, as we know, the UK version of Section 15 of the Australia Act works, and if governments and courts respect that the Australia Acts are a package, that they are two sides of the same coin, that they are critically linked to each other and must remain linked to each other, then all these arguments become hypothetical and we don't really have to worry about them. So on the 3rd of March this year, we can very happily say, Happy Australia Act Day. Thank you.
Thank you, Professors Toomey, Brown and Smith. Now, are there any questions? Yes.
Jeff Simpson, just a humble law student. For Professor Brown, a quick question on the assumptions to your research. You seem to be assuming that people who are in favour of a referendum will in fact vote yes, whereas those contrarians amongst us might want to just vote no, but be quite happy to have a referendum just so we can bury the thing for another generation. Did you manage to sort of dig down at all into those people who are, sorry, who are supportive that they would in fact vote yes?
Yes, and some of those other slides have got some of the breakdowns. Some of the analysis there is dependent on the survey. You're quite right. We know for a fact from some of the analysis we can do on the survey that there is a proportion which we can't necessarily always put our finger on in relation to the Indigenous recognition question. There's a proportion of people who are saying, yes, they think it's important to have a referendum, but they're not going to support it. That's absolutely true. So that's why for some of that analysis and some of the analysis, you can drop back to just simply those who think it's very important, where there's a higher proportion. But we know, the short answer is we know it precisely in relation to the local government question. We didn't know any of this was going to happen when we ran the 2010 constitutional values survey. So we don't, the questions don't allow it in relation to the Indigenous recognition question. But assuming we or somebody cobbles together the money for next year's survey, you know, we can ask the questions that will give that definitive picture if they haven't been asked sooner than that, which would be ideal if they were.
Thanks. A question for Anne. Anne, do you think that one reason why the Commonwealth may not be able to amend the Australian version of the Australia Act could be because it might offend the Melbourne Corporation Doctrine? Would that be a viable reason?
Yeah, there are certainly Melbourne Corporation issues to the extent that anything is part of the state constitution, but there's always been this great ambiguity as to the extent to which fundamental constitutional documents actually form part of state constitutions in the wider sense. So you had issues about that with, for example, Privy Council appeals and those sorts of things. Could the Commonwealth, by its legislation, terminate appeals from the Australian Supreme Courts to the Privy Council just by using its ordinary legislative powers? The Commonwealth argued that it could, section, you know, 5129 sort of thing. But then there was an argument that Privy Council appeals form part of a state constitution giving rise to a Melbourne Corporation issue. That never came to be decided because the Commonwealth legislation to terminate those appeals from state Supreme Courts and Privy Council in the Whitlam era was the argument has floated around for a while, and it's never really been resolved.
A question for Professors Smith and Brown. In a minority government, there seems to be less mandate for any particular exploratory government action. In the context of a minority government at the Commonwealth level, what prospect is there of getting constitutional reform?
I do believe that was Mark Aronson, but I can't actually see where you are, Mark. There you are. It sounded like Mark, anyway. Sorry if it wasn't. I'll just answer that more as a political science, with my political science hat rather than any other hat. I mean, I think that, again, I'd like to try and be positive about these things. We wouldn't have these issues having come back to the forefront of the agenda at all if it wasn't for this particular state of power sharing and minority government. It's also, so that in itself has helped create the potential for us to do some things on these issues in relation to the Constitution. Because of the nature of the political landscape, it's also strengthened the environment, which means that we have the potential for a high degree of multi-partisanship or bipartisanship, which wasn't there before. We also have an accentuated risk of the political incentives that may come to play on an opposition that sees this as an issue that it might score political mileage out of, and therefore adopt a contrary position and see that potential for bipartisanship and multi-partisanship just annihilated overnight. I think we're at a stage where within the next few months we will have to see whether that's the case or not. If the potential for that multi-partisanship, bipartisanship is preserved and grown, which currently it's there on both issues, which is a pretty good thing, trying to be positive about all of this, then I think, you know, there's real potential for a new and different type of debate. But it's the volatility of the situation means that the other side of the coin could equally come into play. So I don't see it as being I see the political environment overall, its fluidity and volatility, as having helped create the potential and potentially to create an environment that can lead to a new and different type of debate and successful, meaningful, visionary constitutional reform. But the volatility also has its risks. But those risks are well known, which is why it's really important for us to be quite sanguine about the message that political leaders need to get about how constitutional experts and the broader community want to see this debate conducted. Not like 1988, for example. Not even like 1999, for example. We're talking about a new and different type of sophistication to the way in which we conduct our constitutional conversations.
Yes. Just a couple of points. I think these agreements do actually create the occasion on which some kind of debate can take place, but it depends pretty much on the issue in question. I mean, in the United Kingdom, what has happened is that the Lib Dems were promised that there was to be a vote on the ballot and changing the first-past-the-post system to some other sort of system, and there was to be a referendum on that. But there was a straightforward promise by Mr. Cameron to promote legislation which would reduce the length of parliaments from 5 years to four. Now, that legislation has already made considerable progress through the parliamentary process in the UK. So far as the proportional representation type voting practices are concerned, what the Conservative government, the government said was, yes, well, we promise you can have a referendum on that, but we're not going to back it. You can, and that's the problem with the unanimity convention of parliamentary responsibility I was talking about earlier that breaks in that sort of situation. In New Zealand, there's a coalition between the National Party and the Māori Party. It wasn't a coalition that Mr. Key actually needed to broker because he had the numbers without the Māori Party. But that included a promise to undertake constitutional reform too. Funnily enough, they didn't quite get round to it until 2 years, really, of the 3 years have lapsed. And surprise, surprise, now that they have decided they're going to do something about it, well, there's a general election later in the year, and so we'd have to put the whole process into purdah for the time being. And, you know, talking to the civil servants about whether there's any, you know, around the prospect of reform, the answer is pretty negative, I have to say. You know, the civil servants themselves just find themselves in a situation where they are treading on eggshells because who knows what's going to happen in the next election. Mr. Key might or might not need the Māori Party, might or might not need to fulfil his commitment that was part of this agreement.
Are there any more questions? No? It seems not. Well, I would like you all to join me in thanking our speakers again. I'm sure you enjoyed it. It's very interesting. Now, just before we adjourn for afternoon tea, I've been asked by the organisers to let you know that the bookshop will close after afternoon tea. So if you want to purchase anything, it has to be done now. Thank you all.